Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 6, 2002. This session is entitled Near the Sacred and is hosted by Deanne Lagerquist. It is part of her series, Christ in the Wilderness. Let's listen in.
For the sake of the tape, I should say that this is the third in a series of sessions called Christians in the Wilderness. And this session is called Drawing Near to the Divine. So we're going to look particularly at sacred space today. My name is Deanne Lagerquist. I'm on the faculty of St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. I'm in the religion department there. I'm trained as a church historian, so no surprise this series has been kind of chronologically oriented as we've moved through the history of Christianity. What else shall I tell you? I've been coming to Holden every summer since 1989, following a long period in my life when I was a resistor and refused to come to Holden Village. Because I thought I could be a perfectly good Christian without ever having come to Holden Village. And I tell that little anecdote today because I think it's relevant to these discussions about what makes a place sacred or not sacred and how we want to hold on to that or to give other people the experience that we've had. You know, I think that was part of my reaction was people would come back from my college from Holden and it was, you know, wow, this huge mystical thing, and I just, it always seemed a little odd to me, you know? So, but then I got here and clearly I kept coming back so that now I'm more than a quarter of 40 years in the wilderness. What I want to do today is see some familiar faces and some familiar faces that I haven't seen this year and some new faces. So I'm going to do just a little bit of review. It'll go pretty fast. I hope it still makes sense. Oh, no, you can't move this. You can't move this because it's all set up. I'm going to show something and then I'll move it. Okay. But this, you've heard this anyway. Okay, I'm going to talk about the biblical origins of this motif of wilderness and some various appropriations. And then I'm going to talk about five sorts of Korah, five sorts of place. Korah, and I'll say more about this later, but there are in Greek two words for place, just like there are two words for time. And all of you know that two words for time in Greek, right? Chronos and Kairos. Chronos, clock time. And Chronos, the fullness of time, the appropriate time, the special sort of mystical time. Well, they have that in about place too. Topos and Kora, as in choreography. All right, we'll talk about five different kinds. Four axioms from Belden Lane, four truths about sacred space, and then three scholarly approaches. Okay. So that I'm able to move this, I'm just going to start a little bit out of order and show you this map, partly because I forgot to show it last time. But here you have, can you see it a little bit? You can tell what it is, right? It's a map of Israel, Sinai Peninsula. It's from a book that was published in 1888 called Out of Egypt into Cana, or Lessons in Spiritual Geography. Okay. And so what it shows here is the individual Christian person's interior journey out of bondage, spiritual night and bondage in Egypt, conversion and conviction, into Sinai, spiritual twilight, through the desert darkness, justification, a little bit of backsliding, and then into the promised land of perfect love with sunshine, purity, and power, unless you wander off into Babylon, where spiritual night is intensified. Okay, so we have this motif of wilderness that gets used variously. Here it's being interiorized for the individual Christian spiritual life. Where does this come from? Now I can move this out of the way. Okay. Can you see now? Not this, but the whiteboard. Okay. Okay. Wilderness, of course, comes into the Christian vocabulary, the Christian set of images from a very specific, I would say, paradigmatic event. So we have wilderness experienced by the Hebrew people. Okay? Who and when, you know, kind of when. Where was it? It was a very specific kind of landscape. The geophysical context was very specific. It was a desert, dry, arid, sandy. In the ancient Near Eastern view, desert is always contrasted to cultivated land. Dry land where nothing grows, wet land where you have groves and vines and herds, right? I said last time about how that's where you can't have milk and honey unless you have grass for the herds and flowers for the bees, right? You gotta have water for that to happen. And so this desolate place where the Hebrew people went was a desert. What happened to them there? Well, first of all, they had escaped from Egypt. While they were out there in this desolate land, there was a temptation, the story of the golden calf, right? The longing to be back in Egypt with the leeks and garlic and fish. I bet it was pickled fish, right? They wanted to be back there and have those puckery foods, not looking forward to the lush foods of the Promised Land. And they also received the covenant. Now this is important when we think of how the motif gets appropriated, because from the very beginning, it's not one thing. Being in the wilderness isn't just bad, or being in the desert. It's being free from captivity. It's getting the covenant, but it's also always dangerous because it's dry out there, right? It's not that they were just longing for the old food. They needed food. They really would die without water. Now, if we look at the way that motif of wilderness gets interpreted and appropriated in the Old Testament, we see that variety, that multivalence, scholars of religion would want to call it, multivalence, many values, gets played out. At least these four things. What does wilderness stand for? Based on this specific case, it stands for a moral wasteland that is also a potential paradise. That ambiguity is there. It stands for a place of temptation. It stands for a time of covenantal bliss. Hosea uses it that way. He speaks to the people of Israel, recalling their years in the wilderness, not as a time of temptation and trial, but by analogy to a period of betrothal. Okay, the sort of heady euphoria. And then also the wilderness is a place of refuge and renewal. Okay, so that's the origin of this biblical motif, and it gets used in various ways. We've talked about the monastics, the hermit tradition by 400, people going out into the Egyptian desert because it wasn't the city. And they come to see the city and civilization, the temptations of an easy life, as dangerous to their spirituality. They also, by this time, began to see that the legal status of the church has changed, and that the church begins to have pretensions of paradise, to begin to think that this earthly life is not a time of wilderness, but that they've already achieved paradise. And so these hermits say, we're going to go out into the wilderness, out into the desert, and although it's dangerous to us physically, it will give us an opportunity to be tested and to be renewed. Okay, so they use it in that way. We also talked yesterday about the use in the American context, the Puritans, who come to settle in New England in the 1600s, and they come and their landscape, the geophysical reality that they encounter, is quite different. It's forest. Now, actually, that's what the English word wilderness refers to. It's more like a forest, the etymology of the word refers more to a forest where wild animals live. And it's not dry. It's green and verdant and lush. But it's still dangerous. It's still dangerous. You can have the same experience of a moral wasteland and temptation and so forth, but it's a very different landscape. They regard it as being not the English church. They're trying to get away, even as the hermits were, from a church that wasn't totally reformed. Then we found the pioneers continue this in a certain way, but they begin to see the wilderness as something to be controlled, rather than just to be afraid of. Now the pioneers say, we'll make use of it. We'll cultivate it. We'll make it into a garden. And we read from Rolvag, Per Hanse's goal, what he was going to do with that prairie that his wife was absolutely petrified by. That's another landscape. From the Puritans to the pioneers, we begin to move from what seems to be a largely negative view of wilderness to a utility use, which begins to be positive. And then we traced through the romantics, the transcendentalists, people like Thoreau and Emerson, then to John Muir and to Aldo Leopold, a different view. The romantics began to think of the wilderness in terms of the sublime. Now, their experience of the wilderness has really changed. They can take a train there, right, and go up into the Adirondacks and spend a lovely week at the lake sitting in an Adirondack chair, right? How it can be more lovely, right, than sitting in one of those chairs just like we have up here. So they see the wilderness in a very different way. And they begin, as we see in landscape painting from the Hudson River School, to see the wilderness as access to the sublime. And the monumental and the big and the thunder isn't so frightening because it's not a matter of survival. And they contrast it. Now, am I doing like huge broad strokes here, right? Phew, just like this. But they contrast it with the wildness of the city. And so the city is the wild place, and nature is not so scary anymore. In the ecological movement then that comes in the early 20th century, the place of human beings in the whole scheme changes. We talked a little bit about this, that even as the view of wilderness is changing through here, so is the view of human nature. Why are the Egyptian monastics and the Puritans thinking wilderness is bad? Part of the reason is they understand that the wild part of human nature is sin. And the danger, if you go out into the wilderness, is not only that you might die, but that if you don't die, you might become wild yourself. You might, that in the vocabulary of the time, go native, right? And you become a savage. That's very scary to them. And the examples where it happened made them really scared. But by the time we come to the Romantics, view of human nature has changed very much. It's a much more, call it a high anthropology, a much more positive anthropology. People like Emerson and Thoreau think that you can intuit what is spiritual and true by looking at nature. And then when we come to the ecological view, we begin to see human beings as part of this whole big system, not separate from it, not wanting to conquer it or cultivate it like the pioneers. Okay, so that's a very fast
review.
Question. Yeah.
Where does Conrad then fit in? Because he,
Conrad,
you know, Heart of Darkness.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's where the go native, you know, notion.
Yeah, but he's more positive about it, do you think?
Well, it's more, I don't know, it seems more, it's kind of ambiguous. I mean, there's definitely a romantic, it definitely romanticizes.
Because in the Romantics, there's that notion of the noble savage,
yeah.
Right?
But it's also pretty. It's pretty grim.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and that's of
so
course Rick, isn't it the problem with broad strokes?
Right.
But that if you know even an iota more than I'm saying, you can see where I've left out a nuance.
I see, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And given that my thesis in all three, Belden Lane Landscapes of the Sacred, the expanded edition is really what I'm working out of. And I did a little pilgrim at Tinker Creek. I'm going to read from Gail Ramshaw's Letters for God's Name. One of my theses about through all of these is that wilderness is ambiguous. Wilderness has both positive and negative meanings. Wilderness is filled with tensions. And the tensions in each appropriation are a little bit different. Okay, so then let's, we're going to come and talk about five sorts of Korah, five sorts of sacred space. But before we do that, I want just really quickly to hear people name some sacred places. Either specific places or kinds of places, natural places or constructed places. So let's just hear some.
Church.
Church? Okay.
All right, waterfall.
Waterfalls.
The ocean.
The ocean.
Woods.
Woods. That very forest that is the wilderness.
Prairie.
Prairie.
I'll give a specific, the Himalayas.
Okay.
But any mountain.
And I got to scribble because I can't spell.
Yeah, it's close. It's good.
Probably galaxy. Sky to sky. Stars.
Wildflowers.
Okay, so.
You have a thing going on in Pierce County right now where Associated Ministries people, it's a conglomeration of religious folks, and whenever anyone is killed on the street, they go there and they create a sacred place. So it's a place that has been blessed.
Site of death.
Yeah.
And you see that in Greece,
but a site of death that's been blessed, not
right.
Just a death site, but where people have come together and said, this is an okay place. And there's one on the PLU campus now, because they don't want everybody to get the creeps when they walk by there.
Right. An excellent example, and one we want to come back to as we go along.
Machu Picchu is one too up in the Andes.
Oh, yeah. And that's of course a built place.
Uh-huh.
A built place. Okay. Yeah.
How about the places that sometimes evolve or chosen for spiritual disciplines of reading or praying or meditating?
What's that place?
For example?
The left end of my sofa.
Okay.
In Holden Village.
But, lots of people talk about a particular chair that they have or a corner of the room that includes the light and, a candle or whatever.
Roberta Bondi writes about the red chair she sits in when she prays. Yeah.
The big rock down by the river.
Oh, yeah, I know that rock.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big rock, long rock.
Yeah. You're a Faustinian.
Okay.
What's that?
It's the meditation room up on the second level in the village center on the far end.
Last summer we were in Bali and there were a few temples. We visited a lot of, what do you call them?
Temples.
Hindu temples. And there were some that I would just walk in and they were interesting for some reason or beautiful. And there were others that I would walk in and a feeling would wash over me. And I just knew this is an ancient sacred place.
Some temples
in my body.
And this is great. This limitation you're putting on there.
Yeah, there were different.
Some temples.
Yeah.
Archaeological sites.
Some are, okay, archaeological sites.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A specific one, the Mezquita in Cordoba, Spain.
You're all giving me things I don't know how to spell.
Mezquita, along those lines.
Q-U-T-E-A, Cordoba, okay. you see the wide range of kinds of places, right? And when people started to name, I mean, when Gertrude said the big rock, those of us who know that rock, it's sort of, there's a memory calls up immediately that's there, right? And when Roxy talked about the PLU campus, those of us who know the story of that murder on the PLU campus, it immediately calls something up. More so than simply her example of places, sites of death that have been blessed, now a specific site that's been blessed where we know the story. Okay, now we could spend the whole day just reading what people have written about sacred spaces, and I hope I've winnowed it down to just a few. Belden Lane and other people say that poets are the ones who help us understand sacred places the most. That people like him, who's a historian of Christianity, or historians of religion like Marcia Eliada or Jonathan Z. Smith, give us some tools, but the poets are the ones who help us join in the experience, right? Because there's something going on there. Now, we heard this morning Updike say, don't make the resurrection just into a metaphor. And yet, there's something about metaphor that gives us that access. So I want to read you one short poem called Epiphany, which is about the kind of space David talked about, the prairie. Epiphany. Lynn Schmidt says, she saw you once as prairie grass, Nebraska prairie grass. She climbed out of her car on a hot highway, leaned her butt on the nose of her car, looked out over one great flowing field, stretching beyond her sight until the horizon came. Vastness, she said. Responsive to the slightest shift of wind, full of infinite change, all one. She says, when she can't pray, she calls up prairie grass. We'll just let that sit. Sacred places can be, as I said, natural or built. They can be very specific locations. That rock, that waterfall, you know, we have a lot of cascades around here. Is Wilson Creek more a sacred place than some other one, right? You know, how does that work? Well, there are various ways we get at it, and I don't, this is my own typology, and we'll see how it works. But I want to point to what seems to me five different ways of getting at sacred places. One is very ancient in the history of Christianity, and that's called the Two Books of God, going back to the time of those hermits, John Chrysostom of Constantinople and others, clear into the 19th century, talk about the two books of God, the Book of Nature and the Book of Revelation in the Bible. And the expectation was always that the same God, because the same God gives these, we'll find the same message there, right? So when we look at nature, it's God's book and it's God's writing somehow, and there we will find God. This assumes that nature is knowable, that there's some way we can read it, that we can come to understand it, and most often these two work together. Now, just how they work together varies from thinker to thinker. I spent the last 2 weeks at a seminar. One of the people there was working on Luther and his theology at the beginning of the age of modern science. So he was looking at this among other things. And he said, for example, that Luther doesn't really use this image too much, but instead Luther talks about the Word of God and the works of God, the Bible and nature. One of the things that does is make clear that in this tradition, usually you read nature through the revelation. Okay? I think that's related to the second way I'd go at that, namely sacramentalism. Whereas much of Protestant Christianity has wanted to keep the emphasis on the word and not on the works, right? The emphasis, God comes to us through the word, and the materiality of that is pretty much in the incarnation. And one place is pretty much like another place, right? So the Puritans, they didn't paint, they didn't ornament, you know, it was very plain, because it's a particular view of God's spirituality rather than materiality. Very much in contrast, say, to the Eastern Orthodox view. Have any of you ever been in an Eastern Orthodox church? And the icons, right? All over. The cathedral in Alexandroupoli, which is way on the eastern tip of Greece, has modern icons. It's a post-World War II building, I think. But it covers the whole thing. Now, the point of it being post-World War II is it doesn't have so much smoke in it yet, and you can still see the icons. You have a sense of being surrounded by the people of God. It's also in the Christian tradition, but it's almost the exact opposite of that Puritan, Calvinist, stark tradition. Sacramentalism is maybe somewhere in between Roman Catholics, Episcopalians, Lutherans, to think about nature as something God inhabits. Luther does talk about God being in the soup as much as in the sacrament. Something different happens. There's a promise in the sacrament. It's not quite the same as other places. It's another way of thinking of a sacred place. It's a place somehow God has made manifest. A third way is the way deism looks at this. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, the last time we were together. Deism, as you know, about the time of the American Revolution, the idea that God is the maker of the world, and then the world goes on, right? But they also had this confidence that you can look at the thing the maker has made and then back to the maker, that you can learn the creator from the creation. So that's a third way you might think about, out of the Christian tradition, how do we understand places as sacred? One, it's the one of God's books. Two, it's a sacrament. Right? Three, it's what God has made when we look back. If we move out of this more theological approach to what's called history of religions, Mircea Eliade, early in this century, coined a phrase that for a long time was the standard way of talking about sacred place, and it's oxus mundi, the axis of the world, the center of the world, right? Delphi. It's the navel of the world. They have actually a sculpture that looks like a umbilical cord covered with wool. And it's the center of the world, and everything else goes out from it. So a sacred place is a place that's the center of the world. It orders everything else. We saw that talking about the Puritans and the ideal of village organization, where the meeting house is the center and everything moves out from it. It appears in lots and lots of religions, not just Christianity, not just Judaism, not just Islam. Although we see it in Islam, where Mecca, you could say, is the center of the world. Why do you turn toward Mecca to pray? Because that's the axis mundi. Often there's some kind of pillar, right? And then everything goes from it. Yes, I know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a hole.
Yeah, and sometimes it's a hole.
Yeah. I mean,
Delphi. Yeah, and at Delphi it is. Now I'm getting ahead of myself, but Delphi is an interesting place because the geological formations that make Delphi mean that there's stuff going on there, kind of volcanic geologic things going on. The place has something about it. It's not like 2 miles over. Okay, and then a fifth way to think about it is the Celtic way of thin places. Not what's the center of the world, but a sacred place is a place where the membrane between this cosmos and another cosmos, this world and the next world, is thin. Right? And somehow you can see through, or maybe even go through, where you can stay on this side of the Jordan and still taste some grapes and honey and milk, right? So I guess I erased what I wanted to point to, so I won't. But this thin place gives access to another reality. And if you take that historic continuum that I had, I guess I have it here and I can talk about it, but in the paradigmatic example, you have Egypt, wilderness, one of these works, one of them works, promised land. And so a thin place will be here where you can look across, where you can anticipate, where you can maybe even touch. For the Christian, where this works a little differently, you have Eden and the fallen state, right? And then baptism, we'll let that stand for conversion, entry into Christ's saving work, but we're still living here, so the new creation is still ahead, right? So that thin place will be here. Now, Axis Mundi and a thin place maybe have, they have similarities, they have sort of differences. To add this in, suggest one of the things about Christianity and Judaism is that there has been not just the Puritan anti-materiality strand that mitigates against sacred place, there's also been a sort of tendency, or I should say a tension, between place and time. So once the Israelites got into the Promised Land and they built a temple and they had a king, the impulse to stay in place is very strong. Right? How do we know we're with God? Because we're in the right place. What comes after is another wilderness, Babylon, we saw on the spiritualized map, and then time becomes important. And we sacralize time rather than sacralize place, as the Browns did for us yesterday with the Sabbath prayer. You separate this time from that time, this place from that place. That's the meaning of sacred or holy, is what's set apart, what's marked off. Okay, so that's one way of talking about the difference between topos and kora. Kora is a sacred place, like kairos. So again, we have this place-time business going on. Now, Belden Lane tells us what, he makes four assertions about sacred place. Oh, was there one I was going to read there? Well, it's gone now. I'm going to tell you what they are, and then I'm going to go back and talk about each one. And if you want to ask questions or comment on those as we go along, please feel free to do so. One, sacred place is autonomous. Two, sacred place is the ordinary made extraordinary. Three, it's existential, not ontological. And four, it exerts an impulse both in and out. Let's do them one at a time. Sacred place is autonomous. We don't choose it. Now, you talked about one you did choose, your couch, right? The left end of your sofa, building a church. But some temples, not all temples, there's something about the, if you think about this place as sacred, there's something autonomous about this divine, this other, this beyond, that we don't control. I can't quite decide I'm going to make that rock a sacred place. Something happens or it doesn't, but I can't make it happen. There's something autonomous about the sacred. Think of two examples from Scripture, Jacob's ladder. Jacob didn't make that place sacred. God came in the night and gave the dream. And then Jacob names the place and marks it. But Jacob didn't pick it out. Or the transfiguration. And transfiguration is a great example of not just that autonomy of the sacredness, but also the fourth thing, the impulse to stay and to go. Because the disciples want to stay. Oh, God has appeared to us here. Let's make a booth. Let's save it. Let's preserve it. Let's keep it here, right? But the sacred is, Belden Lane argues, autonomous and consequently fleeting, maybe. You can't capture it. The second thing he says is that sacred space is the ordinary made extraordinary. It can be the most elemental place, rocks, water, tree, grass. It doesn't have to be majestic and monumental, although the Romantics prefer that, right? Big, high mountains, large, dark, dramatic clouds with loud thunderclaps and huge lightning. But it isn't always. It can be very small. It's the ordinary that somehow this autonomous power inhabits and changes it, and we're suddenly able to see something we couldn't see before. Now, that leads us to the third, that what we couldn't see before. Belden Lane says, sacred place is existential, not ontological. And you think, ooh, he is contradicting the first one, in which he said, it's its own being. That's what ontology has to do with, beingness, right? The sacred place is autonomous. It has its own beingness. I can't conjure it up, and I can't control it. And now he's saying, it's existential. It has to do with my experience. So in the first case, he's talking about the place, and in this case, he's talking about our experience of it. He puts it this way, you can tread upon it without having entered into it. You can walk across sacred space and not enter into it. Now here, I think of worship, which isn't exactly a place, it's a place in time. Or the sacraments. How many times do you take communion and you think, well, I didn't feel anything. Nothing happened to me. Girl, that was just, why did I even get up today? Just this, you know, this preaching was bad and the hymns were worse and the wine was sour. You know, it's just nothing. It's existential. And in Lutheran theology, we say the efficacy is not dependent upon the subjective experience. It works whether you feel it or not. The place is sacred, maybe, whether you enter it or not, but the experiential does kind of matter. Right? Some people go out and sit on that rock and they don't. It's just a rock. Gertrude finds it to be a sacred place. What's going on there? Patricia Hempel has a wonderful spiritual autobiography called Virgin Time. She tells about making two pilgrimages to Assisi and one to Lourdes. And while she writes beautifully about it, nothing happened. I mean, what more sacred places can you think of? Assisi and Lourdes. Finally, she went to some Cistercian place up in California, and she tells about, she was wanting to learn how to pray. And there she is one morning, outside, with all these sort of middle-aged women in big sweatshirts and sweaters. And this is the moment, she describes the shapes, you know. And this is the moment at which suddenly she has a breakthrough. And she begins to pray. She says, that her first prayer was, I can't help it, it's just the way I am. That was the beginning of praying for her. But so what about Assisi and Lourdes? What happened? How does that work? Well, this is a question. We could read from Annie Dillard about that. We'll see how our time goes. I may come back to that. Three ways I think that are important. One thing is our imagination. If our imagination is not engaged, it's very unlikely that any place will have any character other than its ordinary surface experience. Right? There's something about that part of us which is imagination, which goes beyond the surface, has to be engaged. How do we get that engaged? Two ways that are very important. One is narrative, the story. I went out. I was running from home where I had tricked my brother and my father. I was escaping. I lay down in the night and God appeared to me in a dream. You tell that story to your children, and then when you come to that pile of rocks, they say, oh, that's where Jacob's ladder was. And their imagination is already engaged. Think about Holden. You come with a story. It's maybe your neighbor's story, or your mother's story, or your, you know, somebody's story. And it may be a long story that has the mine in it, or it might be a shorter story that starts with Wes Preeb, right? Or it's just, now see, it didn't work for me because my roommates overdid the story and I'm kind of skeptical. But their story, by the time I finally came, their story was part of my coming up the hill, right? So my imagination is engaged. And I gotta tell you, when I got here, a campus pastor had been my campus pastor in college that summer, was running the summer program. And I felt like I was just whipped back in time 10 years. You know, I thought, oh, this is so familiar to me. Because he you know, Bach, Bonhoeffer, he was doing all this stuff, and I was like, whoa, I didn't have to come to Holden, I was at Holden. But the story, it engages our imagination. Felden Lane says, sacred places are almost always storied places. There's a story with them. Either there's a story before you come, or once you have the encounter becomes the story. Okay? And then another way we do it is by ritual action. There's an approach, and as I was reading this in Felden Lane, this sort of threshold, the liminality, the going from one thing to the next, I couldn't help but think about the boat ride and the bus ride. And you know, Holden would be a very different place if you could drive your car to Lucerne. And if you could drive your car to the Narnia parking lot, there's no parking lot there, but if there were a parking lot at Narnia, and if you didn't like dinner tonight, you could get in your car and drive down to that great Mexican restaurant in Chelan, it would be a very, very different place. So I don't know if you think about that, hanging around at the boat landing, getting your ticket, rushing to get your luggage on, you know, getting on the boat, listening to the stuff about the Narrows and Safety Harbor and blah, 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 as liturgy. But when you go down the lake, think about it. It is.
Processional.
It's a very long processional. And in the Greek temples, there are these long processional, you know, it's set up. So you don't just walk in. You gotta approach. You gotta prepare. You have to be ready. Your imagination has to be ignited. So that when you're there, you're receptive. That's very, very important. Coming and washing and taking off your shoes. It forces, and I often think about this, you know, I just go clump, 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 right into church, boop. Same way I go into the office. If I had to stop and wash and take off my shoes, there would just be that little setting apart. Lighting the candles, saying the prayers. I suppose that's what the prelude is supposed to help us do, right, Dennis? But we're all reading the announcements, complaining about this, commenting on the flowers, blah, 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 blah. So is it any wonder that I go home and say, well, the preaching stank and I hated the hymns and the wine was sour? How can that autonomous power break through if I resist? Now, maybe I will read just this little bit of Annie Dillard because it's so beautiful. She talks about this. About seeing. She says, the secret of seeing is then the pearl of great price. If I thought he could teach me to find it and keep it forever, I would stagger barefoot across 100 deserts after any lunatic at all. But although the pearl may be found, it may not be sought. The literature of illumination reveals this above all. Although it comes to those who wait for it, it is always, even to the most practiced and adept, a gift and a total surprise. I return from one walk knowing where the killdeer nests in the field by the creek and the hour the laurel blooms. I return from the same walk a day later, scarcely knowing my own name. Litanies hum in my ears, my tongue flaps in my mouth, Alion, Alleluia. I cannot cause light. The most I can do is to try to put myself in the path of its beam. It is possible in deep space to sail on solar wind. Light, be it particle or wave, has force. You can rig a giant sail and go. The secret of seeing is to sail on solar wind. Hone and spread your spirit till you yourself are a sail, wetted, translucent, broadside to the merest puff. It can be sought. It can be found, but it may not be sought, she says. It's always a surprise and a gift. So you go in those temples, and probably you thought you were entering all of them the same way, right? You did the same stuff. And some, in some, there's something there, that autonomous power, and in some, it's not. It's always a surprise and a gift, but there is a way of preparing. And so that's the third thing. It's existential, imagination is important, narrative and ritual help. And then the fourth thing that Belden Lane says is that sacred place, and he's very specific to use place, not space. Space is vast, place is specific. But here, he's interested in the way sacred place exerts both an impulse to center and an impulse to go out. Right? Both to stay in the temple and to go on pilgrimage. Or to go on pilgrimage to the center and then to need to leave. There's this tension, and we've seen it in the story of the Hebrews. Right? There's something good that happens in the wilderness. God is present in Egypt. God isn't absent from Egypt. God heard their cry, right? God is present in the wilderness, feeding them, giving them the law, judging them, and God is present in the promised land, but just for them as for the legal church, for the not quite reformed enough reformers, there's this pretensions of paradise that sometimes we want to hold too tight. And then Lane says, the autonomy of the sacred pushes us out. Related to that is, he says, the way in which sacred place is both local and universal. We come to see this village, this little bit of land, as sacred. This piece of bread, these meals, these cups of coffee, but you can't live here forever. Right? Even Gertrude, she's been here every summer for almost all these 40 years.
Right.
Can't live here forever.
Not mine.
Right. It's not yours. And you have to go, but it changes how you see everything else. So there's this dynamic of sacred place, which is very specific, and going down the mountain, as the disciples had to from the Mount of Transfiguration. That tension, or maybe dynamic, is a better way to describe it. You know, Lutherans are very fond of paradoxes and using this phrase, creative tension. Now, I don't know about you, I've never experienced a tension that made me creative. It just makes me tense and grumpy. Except I'm always looking for an image, and finally the image I got is of a suspension bridge or a tightrope. You gotta have both poles or it collapses, right? And so there is this with sacred space. It's both the local and the universal. It draws you into the axis mundi, but it also drives us out on journey to the edges, to the margins, to the thresholds, to those thin places. The Irish talk have a sacred place called St. Patrick's Purgatory, a cave into which people would descend. And there's a long ritual preparation of fasting and prayer over many days before you could go into that place. And then you came out and went somewhere else. It's the other example or illustration of this that I thought of from the banter on, I think it's a Red Clay Ramblers album, which I have on plastic, so it's really old, I know, but they say, in country music, there are always two longings, to be home and to get away from home, right? And if you're at home, you want to get away from home, and if you're away from home, you want to get home. Okay, so lots of different ways of thinking about this. Let me lift out kind of analytically from what I've said. Lane gives us these three approaches. The ontological and essentialist view, that's Iliada's view. What makes a sacred place sacred? It just is. In its being, it's inherently powerful. Somehow, we don't understand, the supernatural invades the ordinary from within. In Christianity, we'll talk about that as being the spirit, right? Or God appears in a dream. Christianity wants to be very specific about who that God is. Thoreau was less concerned about that. Annie Dillard, I'm never quite sure who she's talking about. You know, sometimes I think this is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and sometimes not. Right? The Hindus, they're not thinking about Jesus, they're thinking about something else specific, right? And that's a question to leave kind of hanging there. But it's ontological, it's being, the essence of this place is different from that place. Here's where I want to go back to Delphi and the geologic processes. Stuff was shifting under the ground. Steam was coming up, right?
Well, what about that idea that there are certain places on the earth
vortexes
that have certain energy,
magnetic field
itself.
Yeah, and that's one approach. People will say, and I think it works particularly for natural sacred places.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but what does that say about some little carpenter Gothic prairie church? You know, that one doesn't help us so much with that one. And so that comes to a second approach, which is the constructivist cultural approach. That what makes a place sacred is something about the human experience of it. And that we construct the meaning out of our story. Okay, so was Holden Village a holy place in 1920?
Depends on your, this is where, you know, if you're a constructivist, maybe.
Not.
But, I'm trying to take my own experience of what
Good.
I consider sacred and see if they fit
Good.
Each of these things that you
You're
put
doing
across.
Just what I hope.
And for me, I'm going to throw out mine, and
okay, good.
It has to do with, I had this dream when I was about 21 or 2, where I was on this cliff, mm-hmm. and it was so high above the city that it was in the clouds. I mean, mm-hmm. at first it was like, I'm on this cliff above the city, yeah. and then I realized, oh my God, I mean, like, the clouds
yeah, yeah.
above the city. I mean, it's really high. And I could look down at the city, and there was this feeling of distance. Mm-hmm. And the importance of distance, mm-hmm. and I later kind of came to put it together with all the different places I've been, having to do with, because it could be either temporal distance or physical distance. Mm-hmm. I am so small. God, the world
so
is so big.
And
then the holographic side of it. And all the world is in me.
Yeah. Right.
At the same time.
Right.
But it had the experience of distance, of perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I later learned
Fast
that the word that Latin, the Latin perspective, the Latin is to look down on the city from above.
Huh.
And it's that, it's the distance that makes places. And so for me, mountains, I
yeah.
you know, I always.
But for some people, it's the minutia. And the small and the close.
But there's still the perspective there. I mean, I guess that's what I'm trying to get.
Yeah.
Even in the small, it's you're looking at.
And that's partly this thing about the autonomy of the experience as a gift. So that when Annie Dillard says, "I walked one day and I knew all this, and the next day I didn't even know my name," that to see the ordinary become extraordinary. You know, mountains don't really do this for me. I mean, people have heard me say that about being at Holden. Mountains don't do it for me. I look at these mountains, they're lovely. They're gorgeous. They're beautiful.
That's it.
Yeah, in prairie grass. You know, that vastness ignites it in me. So there is some variety, and that's where, again, the constructivist becomes important, you know. How is it that together we determine that something is sacred? And when we build something, yeah.
I was just saying, isn't there something different when you say, okay, for some people it's the mountains, for some people it's the ocean, for some people it's the prairie grass. But to me, there's something different between when I'm in a place like the mountains or the ocean,
yeah.
the prairie grass, and I feel God, or I feel connected. That's different to me than when I'm in a place where I go, this is a sacred place.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a different
yeah.
experience.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
There are certain spots.
And how do we account for that? And one way to account for it is this ontological way to say it. There's something about the spot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a vortex, there's a magnetic field, there's something about the spot.
Or there's enough history.
Or, yeah,
that
excellent.
There's something left of the, those who have
That's
come
right.
before.
And so if you go a place, I keep coming back to Delphi, but I was at Delphi with students and we talked about this a lot. Why is Delphi feeling important to all of us? How much of it is the way the light was when we were there? If we'd come on a rainy day, would it have been the same? And that's his third way, as he calls it phenomenological, to introduce that there's some interaction between the reality of the place mm-hmm. and the sacred and the person. I think it takes all three. There's something about the place. There's something about this autonomous sacrality. And there's something about the storied or sometimes contested nature where we dispute what it means. Yeah.
I would just say, well, couldn't a vortex be a different place for a different person?
Well, it depends on whether or not it's geophysical. You know, that partly this ontological view wants to say, there's a force, there's a physical force that draws you in.
Maybe not to everybody.
Yeah, I suppose, because magnets only draw metal. And if you're wood, it's not
like
going to
a measurable force in us that's measurable here, but not
But
there.
You said you had a different feeling in different temples, so if you thought of a temple.
Yeah, but see, that's a constructivist.
But my feeling about the temples was that there were, whatever happened in those places all those hundreds, maybe 1,100 years ago, whatever it was, that some sacred places to me are places where
human beings have left
right.
something of themselves in that place that I still feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's different than a vortex or a spot in the earth where I feel it pulling me to the center of the earth. That's a different kind of sacred space for me, or place. It's a different experience, but still a sacred place to me. It's a different
Yeah, go ahead.
You can get that same type of feeling, though, in a cave, like mm-hmm. the Oregon caves. It's awesome. It's mind-boggling. Yeah. You feel God, I guess. Yeah. And it's just...
And then how you interpret it. Now we're back to the two books, right? How you interpret that has to do with the tradition that forms your understanding of meaning.
That's right.
Okay? So, now let me just say one more thing about Delphi. You go there, and of course this is where the oracles work, right? And people would come, and the oracle would go down into the cave and chew the laurels, and that something's coming up out of the earth, and college students all go, oh yeah, well, of course you would see in visions. And then the visions had to be interpreted. So that there's something going on in that place. And then, you know what? Christians built a basilica there, right? Of course, because you want to draw that power in. So too, if you go to Istanbul and you go to Hagia Sophia, I don't know if that was a sacred space before Justinian built this enormous cathedral there. But when the Muslims took over, they took over Hagia Sophia. They took over I didn't know this before, that word, Kora, the Kora monasteries, right? The holy place monasteries. And they put a new niche in. So you're not looking at Jerusalem anymore, sort of off to the side, you're looking at Mecca. So there is a way in which we instinctively, I think, want to tap this, whatever our tradition, this beyondness, this moreness, this vastness. And what we make of it has a lot to do with our actual experience. Am I a tourist in the wilderness? Am I a vacationer in the wilderness? Or am I at danger in the wilderness? You know, am I really afraid I'm going to die? Or do I have plenty of, you know, I have my 10 essentials and I filed a plan, and, you know, then I can kind of look at the wilderness. It's beautiful. I want to keep you 2 more minutes to read you one last thing. And I'm not going to read you the whole thing because it's longer than that, but Gail Ramsch has this wonderful set of meditations, an alphabet set of meditations on God's name. And this is the one, V, for volcano. Starts with a description of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Talks a little bit about El Shaddai, Abraham's name for God. I first read this summer that a hiker fell out above Heart Lake and died, and we looked for him over a week, wasn't it, Gertrude, before he was finally found, but it was a very long time. And so your notion of the majesty and beautifulness of the mountains is suddenly shifted, and I read this. God is not the good and pleasant mountain. God is God, the volcano. God is mountaintop is mush unless it's mixed with God as volcano. Just as theology of reconciliation is foolishness unless first there is terror before the God beyond. God is still beyond. The volcano laying waste our daisies, destroying our idols. No small task this, to find images in the modern consciousness for power beyond. Perhaps we could talk of space, not our local space littered with used up spaceships, but the space beyond, the going out forever past the solar systems, the never endingness, the no edge to the universe, the space from which we have not yet seen light. Not God as the cloud's silver lining, but God as a black hole, the star mass with gravity so great that not only can its light not escape, but its darkness in the end will engulf the universe. Not God as the rays of the sun, but God as the center of the sun. It's a kind of wilderness, right? A kind of wilderness that is both attractive and frightening, mysterious and tremendous. So, thank you.